Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
Today's program was brought to you by Roth Cheese, a pioneer in the U.S. specialty cheese movement. For more information, visit rothcheese.com.
Season 2 of Meetin' 3 is almost here. We're kicking off with a show all about football.
I am excited. It's so much fun.
We'll tell you how to master the tailgating scene with help from some Atlanta chefs.
The sky's the limit when it comes to tailgating.
Yeah, do something that you can pull off without stressing yourself too much.
Then we'll look at what's good and bad about players' diets, whether they're an NFL star or just made the JV team at their high school.
And that's when I was told the first time, well, just take them to McDonald's and feed Big Macs and milkshakes.
There's a greater percentage of guys that have a clear focus on what they're putting in their body.
You know, in SEC school, people are fans, but we also have to realize that they're kids. They're 18 to 22, 23-year-olds.
Subscribe to Meetin' 3 wherever you listen to podcasts and be the first to know when Season 2 drops.
Hello, hello, Internet. I'm Kimberly Chow. I am one of the co-directors of Food Book Fair, a festival of writing about eating. I'm also one of the co-hosts of Recommended Reading with Food Book Fair, which is a show where we invite our friends and family all over the worlds of food and media to talk about what they're reading, watching, and listening to. Just try to cough off camera. But we are very, very happy to be in the studio today with Sarah Forbes Keough and Ralph McGinnis, the publishers, longtime friends and collaborators, and the geniuses behind Put a Egg on It, a 10-year-old zine printed on green paper about food, art, and many other things. Welcome, guys.
Hi.
Hi.
We're so happy to have you. We've known each other for a long time.
Mm-hmm. It's nice to be here. Hi, pal.
Hi, pal. Egg pals. You guys are celebrating 10 years of Egg. If folks listening now haven't checked them out yet, you can find them at Put a Egg on It. Note that it's a, not an. Also, putaeggonit.com. Other places where fine magazines are sold. Congratulations on year 10. There's a beautiful new issue with our friend Aura Wise, our mutual friend, a chef and friend or extraordinaire on the cover. Check that out wherever you can find your favorite independent food and cultural magazines. So we're here to talk about that. And of course, we're also here to talk about what they're reading, what they're watching, and what they're listening to. Ralph and Sarah, you want to go first with your recommends?
You go right ahead, Ralph.
I am reading, 2 days ago, I just bought some magazines. Of course, I read lots of magazines.
Ralph, by the way, for those of you that can't see into the window in the back of Roberta's where we are recording this episode, has brought all of his books and magazines with him, including some in sleeves to protect them.
It's true.
Really appreciate that.
He's really done his homework.
Oh, well, the one I have in a sleeve is a book by Samuel Delaney. And I actually read this book in junior high. And this is a first edition. So
ooh.
I bought it. But the reason I'm reading Samuel Delaney all over again is because he's just really creative in his older age.
Mm.
He's become a different kind of writer.
Okay.
And but I was a big fan of him when I was younger, science fiction. Mm-hmm. But the interesting thing is I never knew he was black,
mm-hmm,
ever. And now I'm reading his books with a different, knowing that.
Mm-hmm.
And it makes sense now that I'm reading this book. I'm like, oh, yeah. There's all these themes in there that are, you know, make sense.
Mm-hmm.
This book,
which one is that?
It's called Babel.
It's
called Babel 17, and it has a very similar idea as that movie Arrival. It's about language. In fact, I think whoever wrote that read this, but I'm not saying. I'm just saying.
Noted.
But it has a lot to do with language, and it's in the future, and it's about language, how learning a language changes your perception. I mean, that's not what it's about, but that's one of the themes. And one of the interesting things about it is there's no real white male character. I mean, there's one, but most of the characters are like, it's a very diverse, all the characters are like a different race.
Mm-hmm.
And
of human, or I know this is science fiction, but I don't know if he dabbles in outside human.
No, well, there are aliens, but the humans are all different races, or they've had lots of work done. Like, people look like cats and have animal additions, like genetic modification. But the main character is an Asian woman who is a genius, and her friend who's an African physician, mm-hmm. doctor. Those are like two of the main characters. And there is a Joe White dude who's like a military man.
Mm.
He's definitely like an archetype of a repressed military man. But he's sympathetic, though. All the characters are sympathetic. So I'm reading that, and that's why it's in a plastic sleeve, because it's a first edition.
Hang on to that.
Yeah.
Do you wear white gloves when you read it?
I get annoying when someone's like, can I look at that? And then they're like, and I'm like, hey.
So yes, then
be careful.
Hey, well, we're very honored that you brought this all the way to Bushwick.
I bought this
on a humid day. On a humid day.
Yeah.
In the back of this radio station pizza store.
Yeah.
To talk about it.
So I'm reading that, and I'm reading
Babel 17,
and I'm reading Luke Sante's "Kill All Your Darlings," which is a collection of essays. And
I love him.
I love Luke Sante. Mm-hmm. I think he's spectacular.
Luke Sante, if you're listening, we would love for you to write for us.
That would be amazing. He just writes about history and, you know, cultural observations in a very direct but entertaining way.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's very accessible and very clever. I mean, sometimes he'll say something and I'm just like, that sentence is crazy. Like, it's just the perfect sentence.
Mm-hmm.
But this essay is a lot about New York and changing New York.
Mm-hmm.
He lived in the Village in Uptown in the 70s and early mm-hmm. 80s. So he actually, it's really interesting to read some essays from the early 90s, because he's talking about the same things people are talking about now.
Mm-hmm.
Only, like, he was observing the things we don't like about gentrification now, but he was already talking about it in 1991. Mm-hmm. And
is this the essay where he talks about being young enough to think that your star has risen, but it hasn't, but you're not able to see it otherwise? I'm not saying it maybe, quite like Luke Sante says it.
Maybe I haven't gotten to that essay, but I read a lot about how he describes life in the East Village and how he was, you know, you'd be walking around on St. Mark's or somewhere and all this amazing, like, people just throw out things all the time. So every day you would be able to furnish your apartment by walking out, and there'd be like stacks of books, antiques, like crate, like things mm-hmm. that are worth fortunes in the future. But and then there was this divide when one day everything was on the sidewalk for free, and then people started having tables where they were selling the exact same things that like a week before had been free everywhere. Mm-hmm. And then the stores opened. So first it was people, they had their tables and they were selling things, and then the stores started opening. So he starts seeing the opening of, he's actually describing the 70s when the stores start opening. Mm-hmm. And then he's talking about, like, you know, vintage clothing stores versus a thrift store versus just finding it on the street in the garbage. Mm-hmm. So he actually is seeing that happen. He's like documenting the A, B, C, D, and he sees everything coming. He's actually writing about what our life is like now, but he was writing about it in 1981. He had this essay, it was published in The New Yorker, the one that I'm talking about, in 1991, maybe.
Huh.
Yeah. He also like disparages some of these essays before in the intro. He's like,
but that's interesting.
I know.
So he's like, well, I wrote this at this point and I feel differently now, or is it?
No, he just thinks, like, he's a better writer now.
Oh.
We're always improving.
Yeah.
And getting more free.
That's the idea.
Yeah, he's not evolving. He's not like the stuck up guy. He's very down to earth. And very, like, working class in his he's intellectual, but he's definitely working class, and that's probably what I find it interesting.
The book is Kill All Your Darlings.
Can we go back for a second to what you said earlier about from his essay. What was that again?
I am forgetting the line now, but I remember when I first read it, and I was like in my early 20s. There's a line about living in the Lower East Side or the East Village at a certain age and wandering around and feeling like your star was up.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like it was your time.
This
and being too young and too dumb and too confident to realize that everybody else has always thought the same thing at the same time at that age.
Yeah. This got me thinking that we had this conversation with Penny Arcade in an issue a couple issues ago that was a similar kind of idea. It was like a little bit that and a little bit also like everyone arrives in New York at a certain point and then, you know, nothing is ever the same as when they got here later. And so everyone's sort of complaining about that trajectory. But then, you know, there's always like a million other people that got there 10 years before and then 10 years before that have basically the same story.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So well, interesting.
The main difference is when he came to New York, he was from New Jersey, I think. He's from New Jersey. So it wasn't, he didn't come that far. But when he came to New York, you literally could have a few dollars in your pocket and you could start making your way.
Yeah.
So that's a big difference. Mm-hmm. And he talks about that too. So that's one of the differences. It might be the same. People might be saying the same thing, but the people who are broke coming to New York, who are trying to make their way, there's less, they're non-existent. So like people, pretty much everyone.
Yeah, that story that you hear from like Patti Smith and him and kind of everybody who came at that moment, it doesn't really exist.
Yeah. You can't come to New York broke and like become published in the New York. I mean, it just doesn't happen.
Sure. I mean, I think, you know, that line that I'm quoting and I have to reread that essay for context, I think it is about being in New York and being in a certain place in New York and a certain time, of course, but it's also being of a certain age.
Yeah, yes. For sure.
Which I think, you know, you all have to be proud and dumb and smart and brilliant and overconfident
all at the same time.
All at the same time, between
you had to believe
16
in cool.
to 29, depending on like what your
you had to believe in the whole idea of cool.
For sure.
Yeah. So when you get older, the idea of cool, your idea of cool, you become a little jaded on the idea of cool because it's been so commodified. But when you're younger, you're so in it that you're not questioning it yet. So I think Luke Sante is probably someone who enjoys looking at the past, but doesn't really wear rose-colored glasses.
Mm.
I think he's pretty accurate.
I think he's pretty kind, though, when he describes that.
Oh, yeah. He's very kind.
He's not, like, you know, belittling youth.
No.
I miss that
feeling.
Oh,
no. No, not at all. In fact, everybody... He has a warmth about... Well, he definitely likes characters.
Yeah.
Of all types.
As
like,
do I.
He likes to observe people.
Mm-hmm.
So... I hate the word interesting, sorry, but it's interesting. So I'm reading that. I love him. He's my favorite, actually. But beyond what he says, how he says it is pretty, like, amazing to me. Like, kids should read his books in history class. This is the kind of person who should be writing history.
Oh, my God, totally. Mm-hmm. Everyone should read Low Life.
Yeah, Like, it's so it's entertaining. It's real. It's, like... It's not like the common textbook history with like a timeline where you like say this event and this event. He actually describes the history of New York through the lens of criminality.
Mm.
And it really changes your whole view of, it also makes sense with Donald Trump as our president because Donald Trump seems like a character from the history of New York of, you know, Boss Tweed.
Tammany Hall.
Totally. Donald Trump is like those characters.
Sketched with a lot of ink blots, like just like drips and stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. So Luke Sante.
What else you got?
And Babel. And
yeah, you got a big pile over here. We want to
know. And I'm reading The Baffler, which is one of my favorite magazines that I actually read all the way through. And
let me know when you're done with it so I can borrow it.
I really like it. It's got a socialist bent to it, but I think that's a little simplistic. I mean, it's mostly essays, not as many creative writing pieces, but like observations. They do have some poetry and things like that.
Mm.
I haven't gotten that far in this issue yet, and I read the cover story, which is by, I want to say her name correctly, Mia Tokumitsu. Did I say that right? Do you think?
I don't know.
I don't know, Ralph. I can't see that.
You're a good pronouncer. You pronounce everyone's name correctly. I always mispronounce everyone's name. I like this essay because it relates to a lot of things I have been thinking about lately, which is the corporate co-option of wellness, self-care, social justice issues. And she's a little, she is ruthless. And she's a ruthless writer. Things she's sympathetic to. She's a really good social critic. So she could even be talking about herself. I just have some of these. I was like laughing out loud last night when I was reading this, the, some of the things she was saying. I don't want to find it right now. I'm like, I need bifocals.
Just buy it and read it.
We're going to buy it and read it. Why don't you tell us one more thing so we can also get to what Sarah Forbes Keough
is. Sorry. I'm reading the New York Times Education. I'm reading the New York Times Education issue, and I read the story about the teacher who was fired at the Quaker School Friends, which is by Stuyvesant Park. And that ties into the Baffler story, too, because this teacher was the very last Quaker teacher at the school.
Actual Quaker.
Yeah. He's an
actual... Practicing Quaker.
Yeah, he was the very last one. And over the last 20 years, the school used to, you know, give lots of scholarships. It was a community school. Probably most of the people who went to school there were, like, East Village types, like arty people sending their kids there. But in the last 20 years, it's gotten to where it needs to be competitive with all the private schools. So it's kind of changed how it does things. And this teacher, who is like a weird, awkward guy, who everyone loves, made a dumb joke. And
he made a Hitler joke.
Right, he made a Hitler joke. But he fired. Right, exactly. But if you read the story, you're like, it's just an awkward...
Jewish and Quaker.
He was just doing Mel Brooks style humor. Yeah. And he got fired. And the really interesting thing is, there's that word interesting, is that Quakers don't really believe in firing. You have to have like a meeting, and everybody has to discuss their grievances. And so the story is really about how, you know, it's basically all these wealthy people who were like, he needs to be fired. We're paying $50,000 a year. He's got to go. But all of the...
This is how they talk.
Oh, yes, absolutely.
Apparently. Also,
these are quotes in the story. They're like...
Tammany Hall era, like, talkie film. Well, they didn't even have talkies during Tammany Hall.
No.
Sorry.
But, yeah.
But so...
Old white history, I'm not familiar
with. So it's like all the Quakers in New York, of which there are probably, like, only 500, they were all, like, outraged that this guy would just... Because the whole idea of just firing someone to them is wrong. And so they were... Plus, they all like this guy. I mean, it's a small community. So they're like, what? And so just the whole idea of the commercialization of this once interesting school. But it's commercialized, but firing someone for supposedly not being culturally sensitive or something, but just doing it out of hand without any thinking about any sense of nuance. So it's just become this, like, marketing thing. It's like... You know, and basically the school is becoming less personal, more corporate-minded. You know, you have all these, like, rules. You can't say this, you can't do that. And so the relationship between a teacher and a student has to be some kind of personal, but also distance. But the personal part is being separated more and more and more as it becomes more of a corporate structure. So anyway... I'm reading that.
That's
and
depressing.
Also, it's a beautifully designed issue of the New York Times Magazine.
Oh my God, it's gorgeous.
Yeah, I really like it.
It came out this past weekend. It's got this beautiful teal cover, this beautiful, like, their
type
use
treatment.
Of type.
It's on the website, too, in the magazines. And when you hover over the stories, it, like, gets kind of blurry. And then and then you see the whole thing.
Yeah, they did a really beautiful
job. It's really good. I mean, I don't usually like to laud these big, huge things. I like indie media. But the art direction on the New York Times Magazine is... always really good.
I like also that they put the effort and they have the resources to do it, and I'm glad they use those to have an online experience.
Yeah, me too.
That also brings joy and pleasure and the reader's experience of that.
You can read aesthetic. That story online.
Yeah.
The one I was just...
I read the one... I have to read that story. I read the one about a specific school and its principal in Atlanta. after No Child Left Behind.
Oh, yeah, I haven't read that yet, but that's on my list.
It's a lot.
That's what the whole issue is about.
Teachers just want to teach.
Yeah.
But the classroom has become a battleground, according to the headline.
Well, I think it's true. And then I got the new issue of Interview, which excites me because I'll just say this really quick. I haven't read it yet.
It's also on my list.
Ralph can see me like.
Okay, I'll just say I like the Interview.
Longest intro ever. I love you.
Interview I didn't like for a long time because I feel like it lost its way. But just by the cover, it like screamed out in the magazine.
Tell us.
As Agnes Varda.
Agnes Varda,
who is a filmmaker, and she was on the very first issue. The cover of the very first issue of an Interview in 1970.
Can you hold it up toward me?
Yes. It was also shot by Collier Shore, who we love.
I love Collier Shore. But the whole issue is filled with people who are actually interesting and not just, there's that word interesting, and not just famous people.
Not just Martha Stewart interviewing Justin Bieber?
Yes.
Yes, exactly.
It's full.
Though I did love that interview combination.
Just flipping through it, it's covering the things that I would think.
I'll take over from here to tell you because I actually read it.
Please do. Please do.
I read it at the beach the other day and it's very good. It is also on my list. The design is good. It's like
it looks like one of the old Interview covers too.
Yeah.
Like after they stopped doing the illustration, but
it's like a departure from things that are really like tidy. The type is all over the place in like a cool way. And I don't know. I enjoyed it and I liked the stories. So I'm excited for them to keep going. So there's that. Do you want me to tell you what else I'm reading?
Tell us what else you're reading. Yeah. Okay. Or watching or listening to.
My apologies for not bringing all the stuff with me, but I made a list.
Okay.
I've actually been reading a lot of things on my phone because I've been traveling a lot. So I've downloaded like a library app and I just like check things out of the library on my phone.
The real library? Like the
New York
Brooklyn
Public Library? Yeah.
Okay.
So I just read The Ministry of Utmost Happiness, which was amazing.
Ooh.
You must read it.
I have not read it yet.
Yeah, I mean, it's like her first book in like 10 years or something.
Arundhati Roy?
Yeah.
I just read The God of Small Things.
That one's amazing, but I think it came out like 10 or 15 years ago.
Yeah, it came out a long time ago.
And I loved it at the time, and then I was kind of waiting. I knew that she was working on this book for some time, and so when it came out, I was like, yes, and so I read it very quickly, and it's very long and amazing and very what's the word? It's like immersive. Like I was kind of like, I can't eat dinner or talk to you right now. Like I have to finish this book.
I read God of Small Things after another friend was talking about Ministry of Utmost Happiness and it coming out this summer. And I was staying at a friend's house in LA that had a copy of God of Small Things. And I read it and it just like knocked me to the ground.
Yeah, it's the same. And there's a ton about Kashmir and about that like ongoing long struggle that I didn't know anything about. So I feel like that was a really heavy and amazing way to read about it. And it's through, you know, the stories of these different people. So there's that. And then I was traveling a lot and I read every single Walter Mosley Easy Rollins book, which took a while, but I was on a lot of long flights to Singapore and stuff. So that's on my list. And then...
what were you doing in Singapore? Multiple flights.
Yeah, I was doing a photo project for a job, another side thing, a non-put an egg on it thing. Though in service of put an egg on it, I ate as many breakfasts as humanly possible and they have a lot of breakfast there, so... I ate like five breakfasts a day.
We
got to
talk about that.
Dude, I have many issues with Singapore in general, but the food is so insane that like, I think I would just move there to eat breakfast.
Did you see Crazy Rich Asians?
I haven't yet, no.
They talk a lot about street food in the movie. I think that's the best part of the movie when they talk about street food. That's not a spoiler.
Good to know. It's sort of on my list to watch at some point. And then because of the David Wanarovich show at the Whitney. It's like reignited my long love for him. And I've read, you know, I have like the Waterfront Journals and like Close to the Knives. I have like as many books of his as I could possibly have already. Mm-hmm. And then now there's more.
That's one of the first things we bonded as friends over.
Yeah, was our love for him. And so because of the show, there's a new catalog and there's a book of taped diaries called The Weight of the World. Ooh. And I've been reading that. And I spent all day yesterday and half of today reading that actually, and it's amazing.
That's amazing.
It's just like, it's like in a period of his life where he wasn't writing much, and so it was just like him talking, and so he's talking about dates and he's talking about like his experience kind of like getting close to people and freaking out about it. It's just like really personal, but it's beautiful. And then I've been reading California Sunday, which I love.
I love that magazine.
Yeah, if anyone doesn't know, it's a magazine in California that covers the West Coast, Asia, Latin South America. And Central America, and like Hawaii and places like that. And
distributed in the newspapers.
Yeah, distributed in newspapers in California. It's amazing. The quality of their content is incredible, and the photos are amazing as well. So I've been reading that a lot. And Ralph and I are actually going to go see them in San Francisco.
Oh, amazing.
And then go to Pop-Up Magazine, which is their live.
I love that experience.
Yeah.
I went to my first Pop-Up Magazine last year. For listeners, I feel like we have a lot of listeners that probably also love Pop-Up Magazine.
Yeah.
But for folks that don't know and are excited to know, it is an event where the stories only exist at the event. Mm-hmm. And they're read out loud or they're performed. There's often music. There's dance sometimes. There are all sorts of different kinds of multimedia visuals. Pretty special.
Yeah, it's definitely a cool, like, immersive experience. And cooking wise, we got the Superiority Cookbook, and I just made Superiority Burgers yesterday for the first time,
yum,
which was kind of fun. It turned out really well. I thought of you. I did not save you any. Sorry, Ralph. But that was good.
You made the original Superiority Burger?
Yeah, I made
burger.
The burger and the broccoli salad, which are my two favorite things.
Oh, those are there. the best things there. Oh,
so,
man.
So FYI, the cookbook works pretty well. It was like a bit labor intensive, but it turned out delicious, so I would try it. Shitra Agarwal was who does Brooklyn Deli. She was in our magazine in this issue. She did a pickle recipe, and so because of that exchange, I bought her cookbook, Vibrant India, and it's fucking awesome.
It
can
is.
Can I say that on the?
You can say that. You okay, can say good. That here. It's really
it.
That awesome.
It is that awesome. So I've been kind of making my way through that, and it's quite special.
Yeah, that's a beautiful book.
Yeah, so I would recommend that to everyone who wants to eat some Indian food and just enjoy a nice book.
Wow, you guys consume a lot of stuff.
Yeah.
And you should see my...
I'm also reading Kim Gordon's book right now.
I have a lot of unread material.
I love how diverse and varied your consumption is of different kinds of media. And I feel like from the conversations that we have as collaborators, as well as friends and people that have known each other in the indie food media space for a long time, I can see a little bit how it like informs your work as Put an Egg on It. And I'd love to talk about that and 10 years of y'all doing that after the break. We're going to take a little break right now and maybe eat some pizza. And also remind you that Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. They support us and dozens of other shows like us talking all about the world in and around the world of food. If you can go to heritageradionetwork.org and pledge your support, and review the show as well as the others on the network, that would be greatly appreciated. Again, go to heritageradionetwork.org. If you love us, if you love HRN, click on that beating heart and become a member to keep us on the air. We'll be right back.
Today's program was brought to you by Roth Cheese, a pioneer in the U.S. specialty cheese movement. Roth is in its 25th year of making specialty cheese in the rolling hills of southern Wisconsin. With strong Swiss heritage, Roth is best known for its award-winning Alpine-style cheeses under the name Grand Cru. Fresh Wisconsin milk, combined with expertise in affinage, is how Roth creates high-quality, great-tasting cheese year after year. In 2016, hard work paid off when out of over 2,000 contenders, Roth Grand Cru Sirchois was named world champion at the World Cheese Championship. For more information, visit rothcheese.com.
Hello, hello, hello. Hey, we're back. I'm Kimberly Chow. I am one of the co-directors of Food Book Fair, a festival of writing about eating. I'm also one of the co-hosts, alone today in the booth, Missy Amanda Dell, of Recommended Reading with Food Book Fair, which is a show on Heritage Radio Network where we talk about what we're watching, reading, and listening to with our other guests in and around the world of food and media. I'm joined today by Sarah Forbes Keough and Ralph McGinnis.
Emerson McGinnis.
Ralph Emerson McGinnis. We're going to do, the full name treatment.
Yeah. What's your middle name?
Twin An.
Nice. Twin An.
Yeah.
Oh, I said it right.
Oh, yeah. Good job, Ralph.
I'm shocked.
Backing up real quick. Sarah Forbes Keough, Ralph Emerson McGinnis. They are the publishers of Put a Egg on It, one of the OG food zines printed on green paper since 2008.
Eight.
They're celebrating their 10th year anniversary. They have a big, new, beautiful issue that came out this summer that's twice as big. More stories than ever, more photographs, essays, recipes. We were just talking about all the different things that they read, watch, and listen to, and they consume outside of the world of media as well, and just sort of talking about how it informs in their own way, in collaboration and friendship and creative energy, the magazine. How do you distill all of that into what you do together?
Well,
tell it.
Tell it.
Well, one of my top favorite old magazines was Wet, which came out of LA in the 70s. And it was Wet, the magazine of gourmet bathing.
That's such a good...
It's so amazing.
So it was a progenitor of New Wave.
Mm-hmm.
It has that aesthetic that in the 80s,
mm-hmm.
Lots of like Art Deco colors and things like... That's the kind of the design. Is Art Deco was definitely like Art Deco, neon, yeah. Things like that. But it was all around. So they jumped... It started off being about everything having to do with swimming or bathing.
Mm-hmm.
That's where they jumped off.
Gourmet bathing.
Yes. Mm-hmm. So architecture, so things, anything relating to architecture. But that's really simplistic about... It wasn't like just about like soap and water. So they use that they use that as a lens to explore so many things from so many different points mm-hmm. of view. And it was just an editorial way. It was like a lens, you know.
Yeah, it was just a way of focusing.
It was a device.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And it helped create editorial focus. But it just wasn't that simple. It was more than that. And that's kind of how we came at put an egg on it, and how we would use food in the same way that they used gourmet bathing. And you know, we don't usually even have food writers.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody eats food. So, and it really, for me, when I read a novel, I love parts of novels when there's like a family meal,
mm-hmm.
and it's not really about the food, but in the act of everyone sitting around the table, you like learn about all the characters in this in
yeah,
a dynamic
and their relationship with each other.
Yeah. Like I really like the scene in Wonder Boys by Michael Chabon, where they go to a Seder.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a really huge chunk of the book, which they cut out of the movie completely. But it all takes a...
The film adaptation starring Michael Douglas?
Yeah.
Yes, the very one.
I love the movie, but...
No Seder in the movie.
Well, there are wasps in the movie, but in the...
They become wasps in the movie?
Yeah.
And I didn't see the movie.
It's a very small piece. Because in the book, it's a huge chunk of the book. It's like a big... I feel like it was like a third of the book. I'm exaggerating. But... everything you needed to know about every character was because of their interaction over this meal. And it's the same thing in movies. It's the vehicle you learn about. You learn about the culture of the people.
Mm-hmm.
You learn about how they communicate with each other.
Mm-hmm.
Do they talk with their mouth full, et cetera? Like, how do they relate to each other?
All the unspeakable, you know, the stuff that's under the surface comes out
in yes.
the way people interact over the table.
So food, that's what food is. That's how I look at food
mm-hmm.
as being, you know, most food magazines, which I have a problem with in any subject, is about aspirational living.
Yeah.
And our magazine is not about aspirational living. It's about life. So we use food as a way to get into these other subjects.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know if we're always successful, but I try to have lots of people come at this subject. Like, I really like my friend Greg's essay about coming out to his mother at a Dunkin' Donuts.
Mm-hmm.
And he talks a lot about how comforting it was to be in this, like, corporate franchise. And his mother couldn't get angry with him.
Yeah.
In public.
Yeah.
In this.
In, like a public chain restaurant type
Yeah. place. Because if he had done it at home,
mm-hmm.
there might have been yelling and screaming.
Mm-hmm.
So he talks about that, and he talks about how comforting, you know, the donut, the coffee,
the colors,
mm-hmm. and that's the kind of, you know, that's the kind of story. It's not like, it's not about how brilliant the donuts are.
Right. Yeah. Or and there's a story in our current issue that I'm totally obsessed with, and it was like kind of a long time coming. We worked on it a while, and it's a story by my mom, who grew up in, you know, in the 60s during like lots of like heavy anti-war protesting. And she was in Santa Barbara during a lot of like intense stuff and riots. And so I asked her to tell me about how they ate. And the whole story turns out to be all about like dodging the draft and like just all this crazy trauma that people endured that like sort of followed them throughout their lives. And it's through the lens of like eating food in a community together and building a community when they're all like 18. And it's a really beautiful story. And it was something that I wanted to get at, but I wanted to look at it through like more like physical, like eating and things that rather than sort of like a bigger story about like movements, you know?
Well, one of her friends gets fat to avoid the draft, and one starves himself to avoid the draft.
Both of them
and they
have
live
like
in the same house.
They're best friends, and both of them have like lifelong sort of complications from that experience.
Yeah, and they live in the same house.
That's incredible.
So one is like eating meat and butter. First off, they were hippies, so they didn't eat like that anyway. But suddenly he was drinking like lots of cheap beer, butter, and the other guy's like drinking tea, and they're like in the same room and having meals together.
Yeah.
And yeah, that's what, you know, that's what food is about. You know, it's about all of that. And we're striving for that rather than aspirational. But that's how we bring all our interests in.
Yeah, I mean, I think in the time we've been in community with each other and collaborating and talking about all of the other independent food magazines that have come, some of them have gone as well, this idea of talking about food or using food to talk about other stuff seems to be a greater and greater part of what a food magazine actually is, or quote-unquote food, quote-unquote magazine.
Yeah, it's popping up in the bigger magazines. They are reading us.
Yeah, I love it. I think it's great.
There's somebody at Condé Nast who's there's an intern they send out to go buy all the indie food magazines.
I'm sure.
Absolutely. I think that's a fact.
And another sort of like different direction for us is that now that we have bigger issues, because this one's like double our usual size, we've been able to do other things that are kind of like outside of our realm, like work with a food stylist and do a really stylized shoot, which we have always stayed away from because we were concentrating on the stuff we're just talking about. But with this issue, we're like, all right, well, we have some space. Like, let's see if we can take our lens or like our sensibility, our sort of idiosyncratic style.
Well, we're actually critiquing
food
style we're doing it. It's definitely ironic. So we're doing it fully, but we're also making fun of it.
Well, tell us about the story.
Yeah, go ahead.
So it's a 19th century dinner party where the hostess hates all her guests and has burned all this amazing food. And it's accurate. All the recipes are accurate to the early 1900s.
Yeah, so we're recreating this woman's revenge meal, basically.
We created a revenge meal, and then we actually tell the story. So it's like it's fiction. I don't like to say it's fiction because when you read the magazine, you're like, wait, did this really happen?
I wasn't actually going to say that it was.
I know, now I said it.
Nice going, McGinnis.
But it's written like by Jess Arndt, who I love. She's one of my favorite writers. And
it's by her book also. It's amazing.
Yes.
Jess is great.
Yeah. Oh, you know her?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, we sort of, I mean, I know she probably doesn't know me.
Oh.
But I admire her via Diner Journal.
Fabulous. Yeah, she writes for Diner Journal.
What's her book called? Something Animals? I'm going to look it up.
Tiny Animals?
We're going to look it up.
Okay.
But I believe I saw Jess read first at a party with Diner Journal and Put an Egg on it.
Oh, yeah. That was fun.
At Achilles Heel.
She is... she's just a superb
large
animals, the opposite of what I said. She's just a superb writer. That's just all there is to it. And so anyway, the story is very well researched and it's accurate to the time. And it is kind of the photographs are beautiful of this burned recipes, but it's still kind of the opposite of aspirational, because this hostess, who is this high quality society woman, is saying fuck you. And she's destroying all this beautiful food, and that's amusing to me, personally.
What are some of the recipes in that story?
Oh, I didn't bring a copy of our magazine, so I'm like, wow, which one? Quail. Sarah. We're like drawing a blank.
Sorry, putting you on the spot about your own content.
It's We shipped the magazine like so long ago.
There's oysters and steak and smashed potatoes and a whole fish. I mean, it's a 7-course.
Yeah.
Insane.
It's a big.
Did you feed it to anyone?
Well, we made this clover flavored cake, orange cake.
Cool.
And it was burned on the outside.
It was orange clove cake. It was amazing.
It was burned on the outside, but the inside was fine. So
I actually did all the food. So I cooked and
who styled?
What's her name?
Brianna
Balducci. She's amazing.
Okay, cool.
And our friend Ricardo Roa photographed it, and they were an incredible team. They were amazing. And I cooked with Stephanie Jarmillo, who works with us sometimes. And basically, we made everything, and everything was delicious. And then we burned the shit out of it.
Yeah. We destroyed it. And
so we kept our little snacks for ourselves.
So, you know, there are parts to the magazine. Like, we have, like, the editorial voice is of the whole magazine. The editorial voice is very irreverent, funny, and doesn't take itself too seriously. And then we let the writers and the, have their own voice without too many constraints. And then we also have an aspect to the magazine that's about history.
Mm-hmm.
In the current issue, we have a spread of Black Panther, the Black Panther Breakfast Program in 1968 in Oakland, California. So we have art, history,
photographs from that program.
Yes, from 1968 by the photographer Prickle Jones and his wife. I feel bad for forgetting her name.
Ruth Marion Baruch, I believe.
Yeah.
And his name is Prickle Jones.
Prickle Jones. He was more famous, and she also photographed with him sometimes. They mostly photographed workers and labor type issues. Mm-hmm. And they photographed the Black Panthers because they were getting lots of bad press. And, you know, people were calling them terrorists. But they were doing things like feeding children.
Yeah.
So
among other many amazing things.
They were great.
We went through their archives at UC Santa Cruz and came up with this piece, and it's amazing. I was really honored to be involved.
Yeah. So we always try to take ourselves not too seriously, but also have real cultural documentary and stuff. Trying to like mix it up and create like a and that's why I like having more pages, because you create like
do more stuff.
Yeah, you can try
the,
more.
The balance of it, and like there's a lot more you can add.
Yeah. Yeah. So I like doing that story's called Burned.
Okay.
You know, and I already have my next plan. So for the next issue, more humorous kind of like.
Do you have time for one more thing about it or?
Yeah, we got some time. Sweet. Tell us more.
I was just going to mention that my personal favorite thing that we've sort of evolved over the past maybe like 4 or 5 issues now is the dinner conversation. So we
can you tell our listeners about that?
Sure.
So I know there's like a mix of numbers of people.
Well, the deal is basically we don't really do interviews, but we were trying to think, okay, how can we have people talk about what they're doing or ideas and not do it in a regular interview style way? So we were like, all right, we'll just have them over for dinner and we'll have them talk to each other. So we'll mix up artists. And the idea was to choose people who are at different stages of their careers and who work in different kinds of media.
Mm-hmm.
So somebody who's like, you know, older, like in their 80s maybe, who's been around a long time, somebody who's like a mid-career artist, and somebody who's like, you know, young, just starting, maybe in school.
Yeah.
And then so we get those people together, somebody feeds them, and one of us or both of us hang out, and we just kind of like lightly moderate the conversation just to kind of keep it going, but just like
let them don't really need our help most of the time. It's really great to hear. That's very important to me to like have. When I'm looking for contributors, I always think to myself, who is not like me? And it's not a political thing. It's more like, I think that's just interesting.
Mm-hmm.
I hate that word. Like, I want to hear from someone else.
Yeah.
And I was going to say about this dinner conversation is that every time we do one, I come away from the night being like, I can't believe I just had this amazing experience. Like, it feels like so special. And so I've learned so much. And then, you know, we transcribe it and we put
these three very different people have different lives. They go in different circles. And they're having like food together, and it really does eating. You know, lots of people say this: if you're eating with someone, it really just opens things up.
Yeah, it gets really deep. People have conversations about like their family, about crazy things that have happened to them, and then also just about process, like about like this is how I'm doing this work. And then somebody from a different, you know, who works in a different media might have something to say about it. It just like really builds in a special way. So I feel like that's one of the best things that we've come up with.
Who are the folks in this feature? In this issue,
Sarah Schulman, Ezekwe Muhammad, And Erwin, what's Erwin's last name?
He's like one of my best friends right now, but I don't know how to pronounce his last name.
Oh God, we're such jerks. He is a creative director at Sony, at their record label. And Ezekiel does a lot of photo-based and sort of performance-based, mm-hmm. installation-based work. And Sarah Schulman is a writer and an activist. And it was a really fantastic conversation.
Every single conversation in every issue has been like, whoa.
Also, Erwin cooked, and the food was crazy.
Oh, I was going to ask, how do you decide who to put together, and then how do you decide what's on the menu?
I consider it like just like editing the magazine. Like, we try to get one guest first, and mm-hmm. based on their age and career, mm-hmm. then I think about each other guest as something a little more opposing to what mm-hmm. they're doing. So, like, if we have someone... So I generally wouldn't want two 80-year-olds.
In the same, you
know?
Yeah.
Because, you know, that's not going to be the same dynamic. So, yeah, like she was saying, age groups. Like, that's probably the main thing is the age groups. But I also don't want it to be, like, all white dudes or all women. Yeah. Or all... I want to
mm-hmm. mix it up.
To mix it up.
And then the food?
It depends on... Often I cook, and so I base it on where I am. Like, we've done them in different cities, and mm-hmm. so I'll just go to the farmer's market or, I'll depending on the season. So it's really simple. It's just family style. I like to keep it. You know, people tell me their dietary restrictions too, so I base it off that. But the food is just is designed to kind of be like a little bit of a weigh-in, but not so crazy that you have to talk about it too much.
Yeah.
But the food has been good. So Erwin is...
The food is the what helps you access everything else.
Yeah, yeah. They start talking about the food.
It's the sort of the like entry the first... point, but I don't want it to be so kind of complicated that you get stuck there.
Yeah, they don't want it. Yeah, it's not like this is amazing and they're going to analyze it. But Erwin is of Filipino descent, so he made his version of some, like, he changed the recipes. They're not, like, authentic. Mm-hmm. Authentic. He actually changed the recipes for a guest who couldn't eat certain things. So he spent a month.
Yeah. Much more than I would do. He really tested things out.
He, like, tried different, different spices, yeah. different amounts of salt to try, like, to appease the guest. And it came out pretty good.
That sounds delicious.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was amazing. I left some in the fridge for Jen. The next day she was like, oh my God, what is this?
Yum. Yeah. What also, was it?
It was like black rice with I forget the...
Beef.
Yeah, but it was a dish that's normally pork?
Yeah.
Or it was like beef and... Oh, it was supposed to be beef and onions, but I think it was like venison or something.
Whoa.
Was it venison?
I can't remember.
It was good. There were no onions in it because
someone had an allergy.
Yeah.
That's rough.
Yeah.
No onions.
Different kinds of aromatics.
Well, yeah. He also made like a charred eggplant egg thing that was really, yum. Really good.
He likes to cook. He's a good cook and a good conversationalist.
That sounds good. Yeah. I will aspire one day to get invited to one of these.
Oh my God, we'd love to have you.
That would be fun. Yeah. That would be fun. Well, I think we need to take off in a little bit, but can you tell us what's coming up next for y'all?
Sure.
For Put an Egg on It. And again, folks, you can find them anywhere, everywhere.
Although.
At Put a Egg on It.
Although, one of the biggest distributors for small magazines folded, so we're not in every store we're normally in. So people need to ask their favorite shops.
We're taking it back. We're distributing ourselves now. So
okay.
If you can't find us, let us know.
Yeah.
And
you can also buy direct
yes,
at putaeggonit.com.
Yes. We're in the midst of restructuring. We're working on the next issue. A chunk of it is going to take place in Lagos in Nigeria, and we will probably be there towards the end of the year.
Amazing.
So we're working with a friend there who's going to be kind of a guest editor on mm-hmm. part of it. So that's still in the works. So I'm not entirely sure how that's going to roll out, but that's happening, and we're going to be traveling a little bit, so we'll be here and there, and we're gathering recipes, and we'll have a...
It's hard to talk about stuff you're doing.
We're going to have an art show later, but it's not totally planned. So, you know, we've got stuff, so pay attention.
We're going to pay attention. Again, mm-hmm. you can find Ralph and Sarah at Put a Egg on It. Say that three times fast.
Put a Egg on It.
PutAEggOnIt.com. And ask your favorite independent bookshop, magazine store, newsstand to carry them, or you can buy from them direct.
Indeed.
Thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you for having us, Kim.
Being in community with you and talking all things magazine. Always, always great to see you.
Aw.
Thanks for sharing what you've been reading, watching, and listening to.
Thank you. Thank you.
We'll be back next Tuesday for more recommends. Talk to you soon.
Cool.
Bye.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Recommended reading is powered by Simplecast. Simplecast is a popular hosting and analytics platform that allows podcasters to easily host and publish to apps like Apple Podcasts. If you have a podcast or are looking to create your very first, check it out. Try it for free and save half off your first 3 months at simplecast.com/heritage.
Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.